You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
Excellencies, friends and colleagues, good morning. Welcome to our conference on the Asian paradox. The question we're asking is whether rising wealth and lingering tensions can live together in this world, in this Asia. I'm Shada Islam. I'm Director of Policy at Friends of Europe. This conference is our 2015 flagship event of our Asia program at Friends of Europe, and please also read our commentary on the topic of the Asian paradox. A big thanks to all our partners who have worked with us on this great event today. Now, Asia today, as we all know, is a very vibrant economic region. Trade and investments and global supply chains are booming. Free trade deals, noodle bowls of deals, spaghetti bowls of deals are proliferating, and investment agreements abound. It is impressive. It is indeed very impressive. But Asia is also home to many, I would say too many, unresolved territorial and maritime disputes, lingering historical animosities, and now new great power rivalries. As friends of Europe, we are also friends of Asia, and these tensions concern us, just like tensions in Europe concern Asia. Why are we worried? Because peace in Asia is crucial for global peace and development. Peace in Asia is important for growth and development across the world and to deal with global 21st century challenges. The refugee crisis that we tackle in Asia and Europe is one facet of this crisis, the global challenge we face. Now, we know that headlines in Western papers and also in Asia often always focus on confrontation and rhetorical, verbal disputes between these countries in Asia. But what we really need to know is what is happening behind the scenes. What are the ordinary people, what are think tanks, what are academics, what are business leaders thinking about what's happening there? What are they doing about these tensions in Asia? So a few years ago, I was in Jakarta, and I was delighted to meet one of Asia's most outstanding wise men, former Indonesian Foreign Minister Pak Hasan Wirajuda, who is here with us today, and he is going to give us his assessment in a keynote address on what is happening in Asia. In fact, it is Pak Hasan who all those years ago drew my attention to what he then called the Asian paradox, and it stuck with me, and I said, you know something, Pak Hasan, this is something that Friends of Europe absolutely has to talk about. Why are there still security frailties and fault lines running across Asia? Pak Hasan is, of course, working in Asia to change this, and we are going to try here at Friends of Europe to also make our little modest contribution. Now, it's often said that conferences are timely, but I think this conference is really timely. If you've been following the headlines, you have seen that over the last few weeks, we've seen some rather interesting historical peacemaking meetings in Asia. The leaders of Japan, China, and Korea have just met for bilateral and trilateral talks in Seoul only days before our conference. Did they know that we were going to have this meeting here? Maybe. And the historic meeting, of course, on Saturday between the Chinese president and the Taiwanese leader, just held 2 days before our conference. So Asian security is clearly climbing up the global and European agendas. Our challenge, our intention today, is to make this meeting a bit different, to make it forward-looking, not looking at the past and at history, but at practical steps that Asia and Europe can take together to make Asia a more peaceful and a more stable landscape and environment. So we're looking forward to constructive and forward-looking ideas. I have to say that when we talk about Asia, we're not at this conference or in this publication talking about South Asia. That is a different topic for a different day and a different time. So we're looking forward to a thought-provoking and stimulating conference. Let me just very quickly introduce our panelists for the first session, which is about living with cold peace in Asia. We have selected academics from across the world, I have to say, and especially from Asia, who have written some very, very thought-provoking articles and contributions. Let me start first with my friend Kimi Hara. She's a Renaissance Research Professor in East Asian Studies at the University of Waterloo in Canada. Kimi, thank you very much for coming all the way. Ambassador Ong Keng Yong, Executive Deputy Chairman of the Nanyang Technological University, and of course, better known as the former Secretary General of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN. Aidan Foster-Carter, very famous as well for all the work he's done on North-South Korean relations. He's Honorary Research Fellow in Sociology and Modern Korea at the University of Leeds. Bonji Ohara is a Research Fellow at the Tokyo Foundation. I'm not going to go into details of all the articles and work that Bonji and others have done, but it's all in our conference pack. Sebastian Bersik, Chair in International Political Economy of East Asia at the Ruhr University in Bochum, and also Associate Fellow at Fudan University in China. And we are still waiting for Andrew Yang, who is Assistant Professor at the National Sun Yat University in Taipei, to join us. Before we start our panel discussion, if I could ask Mr. Virajuda, please, to make his keynote address from the lectern. Please, sir.
Your Excellencies, distinguished participants, ladies and gentlemen, a very good morning to you all. It is a distinct pleasure and honor for me to join you this morning and to share my thoughts on a phenomenal development in our own regions, Asia. Asia is increasingly seen as the new frontier of the 21st century, the up-and-coming center of gravity of the world. This perspective is mainly based on the region's economic growth. China's spectacular economic rise and the ensuing economic surge in other key countries in East Asia will play a crucial role in defining what sort of growth is possible to the rest of the world. More and more countries and regions have adopted a look east policy. I was in Madrid last week to participate in a conference on the Silk Road, medium and long-term mega project that China initiated to further connect Asia and Europe through new highways, waterways, railways, and airways. I sense the enthusiasm of our European partners over the prospect of bolstering more trade and investment with Asia. The EU's trade with China is valued at about $2 billion a day, the bulk of which is still by sea. Imagine how much of that revenue would increase when the medium and long-term Silk Road projects are completed. Many people think that the United States' effort or rebalancing would see Washington redeploy much of its armed forces from the Middle East to the Asia-Pacific regions. Actually, it is part of a strategy to gain trade and economic benefits from the economic rise of China and other countries in the East Asian and Asia-Pacific regions. On the other hand, the international community is inured to news of ongoing and brewing conflicts on a daily basis, some of which are similar to those that occurred in medieval Europe. No doubt, Asia is rife with geopolitical hotspots and flashpoints for potential conflicts, perhaps more than any other regions. But what is more striking is that the continent does not seem to be ready to cope with those conflicts and settle them peacefully. Asia has no regional organizations, or at least Asia-wide regional organizations, like European unions, African unions, or Latin American OAS, that can bring order to the continent. And instead, it has various sub-regional organizations such as ASEAN, SARC, GCC, and Central Asia, which deals with crises with varying degrees of success. By way of introduction, I just have presented to you an appetizer of the topic of our discussion, the Asian paradox, which is a relatively new term and trend. In some vein, it is no coincidence that Ian Bremmer wrote an article in the Horizon Quarterly Journal, autumn 2015, titled Asia's Promise and Perils. The title captured the contradictions of the current situation in Asia. Both terms describe the disconnections between the continent's booming economy and its precarious state of peace and stability. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines paradox as, and I quote, a statement that is seemingly contradictory or opposed to common sense, and yet is perhaps true. To me, the topic of this seminar rings true. Asia's paradox is the result of an unbalanced concept and process of community building or integrations, or regional integration, which prioritize economic growth at the expense of political and security development. But allow me to clarify for the sake on what we mean by Asia. Asia is a very large, culturally and geographically diverse, which covers some 56 countries, ranging from Lebanon in the west to Fiji in the east. But in this context, I would refer Asia specifically to East Asia, which geographically comprises of the Northeast and Southeast Asia, which by since 2005, it's enlarged to include India, Australia, and New Zealand. In 2004 and 2005, in the run-up of the preparations of the East Asia Summit in December 2005, I was an ardent advocate for more balanced and inclusive East Asia. I was alone. And that eventually successful. And since 2005, 16 countries, often we call ASEAN plus six, participated in the East Asia Summit annual summit until 2011. Since the Bali Summit in 2011, East Asia Summit was expanded by admitting the United States and Russia. East Asia's population, in that context of 16 countries, is about 3.5 billion, or 47.3% of the world populations. According to the IMF, the total East Asia GDP is about 36.2 billion US dollar, or 48.6% of the world GDP, which is about 77 trillion US dollar. It is not only that China and Japan, which are the second and third largest economy, but also the emerging economies such as India, Indonesia, and ASEAN combined, as well as Korea and Australia, have added the economic weight of East Asia. Economist and Nobel laureate Robert Fogel projected that by 2040, East Asia will contribute of some 65% of the global GDP. The problems in our regions is that institutional building is still very weak. It was ASEAN that started regional institutional building in Southeast Asia since 1967, and it is considered as one of the most successful regional organizations. In the past 48 years, ASEAN has successfully developed a good habit of dialogue to promote not only intra ASEAN cooperations and community building process, but also ASEAN has been very active as a bridge builder and promote larger regional cooperations and community building in East Asia. ASEAN's greatest achievement is the fact that for 48 years, ASEAN relatively enjoyed relative peace and security, and allowed 10 ASEAN countries to focus its time, energy, and resources for our economic development. Hence, ASEAN is now the sixth largest economy, with some 560 million people. In ASEAN, I would say there is no paradox between economic growth and peace and security. And in fact, with the new ASEAN community concepts, which would be put in place by end of this year, I think with this more balanced concept of cooperations, we would be in a position to strengthen this mix of political, economic growth and on the one hand, and political and security. On the pillars of political and security, for example, peaceful conflict resolutions, promotion of democracy, respect of human rights, rule of law, and good governance are high on the ASEAN agenda. At the same time, ASEAN has been an active bridge builder by actively promoting cooperation with its dialogue partners. That's why the term ASEAN plus one, ASEAN plus three, ASEAN regional forum, and ASEAN plus six, meaning East Asia Summit. That's why there is the term centrality of ASEAN, ASEAN in the driving seat. ASEAN Regional Forum, likes it or not, is the only forum of dialogue, but underline is only a forum, not an organization, in the Asia-Pacific regions in dealing with political and security issues. For 21 years, IRF is still focusing on preventive diplomacy and confidence-building measures, PD and CBM, to my regret. Though I must also fair to say that IRF has been able to respond to specific needs by promoting actual cooperations, such as dealing with disasters, natural disasters, communicable diseases, and counterterrorism. On the East Asia Summit, ideally community building process is equally shared between the Northeast and Southeast Asian partners. But China, Japan, and Korea, while they are cooperating closely on economic trade and investment, on their political and security issues, they disagree on many things. That's why they depend on ASEAN. East Asia Summit was conceived as a vehicle toward an East Asia community building process. So far in the past 10 years, this ASEAN-led process focused more on economic cooperations, culminating in the agreements on regional economic cooperation and partnerships last year, RCEP. Through ASEAN sponsorships, free trade areas involving ASEAN was with its dialogue partners, no doubt that East Asia wide free trade area and investment area would be an essential component of RCEP. To my regret, political and security and strategic issues are not on the part of East Asian summit's agenda. In 2011, the United States and Russia joined EAS, making East Asia Summit lost its geographical footing as a vehicle of the community building process in East Asia. Now on the political and security challenges, unsettled legacies of the past history, in particular World War I, World War II, and Korean War, and for 70 years, Japan, China, and Korea are not able to reconcile with their past, and they became prisoner of their past. few months ago, Chancellor Merkel voluntarily gave her advice to Japan to express apology and moves on. We welcome the tripartite dialogue initiated by Korea recently, but as long as Japan has not changed its positions, like the previous summit, I'm not surprised to hear there is no breakthrough at the recent summit in Seoul. Political and security problems number two is on the danger of nuclear proliferations. While threats of nuclear proliferations in other regions, such as in Europe, Africa, and Latin America, have subsided, on the contrary, in Asia, we see a clear danger of nuclear proliferations, extending from Israel in the west to Iran. There was a nuclear deal on Iran. Pakistan, India, China, and North Korea. Only China is a party to the nuclear non-proliferation treaty. If the North Korean nuclear issue could not be solved, and there is no sign of to be resolved in the near future, there are no signs. There is a further danger of more proliferations. And as some countries in Asia might themselves develop their nuclear weapons. Keep in mind that as East Asia's economy is growing, the region is energy hungry. The Fukushima nuclear accidents did not discourage countries in Asia to develop nuclear energy. Vietnam has started building two nuclear power plants and will do more in the near future, and which would be followed by more countries in the region in the near future. Countries such as Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Myanmar have made public their policy to promote nuclear power plants. Third is territorial dispute, both on land and waters. In Northeast Asia, there is a dispute involving islands and its surrounding waters between Japan and China on Senkaku to Japan or Diaoyu to China. China 3 years ago imposed China Air Defense Identification Zone, or CADIS, which is in a way is an attempt to establish an effective occupation. Japan, Korea on Dokdo Islands, and Japan's Russia on Kuril Islands groups. More in the news is not overlapping claims on maritime space in South China Sea, but also on the Paracels and Spratly Islands, involving China and four ASEAN member states, Vietnam, Philippines, Malaysia, and Brunei. On disputes on land, islands, rocks, islets, there are no such international law governing the acquisitions of land territory, but effective occupations. Recently, China has completed the reclamations of reefs and developed an airstrip in the Spratly Island groups, which is in a way also establishments of an effective occupations. On the maritime space, based on the historic claims, China claims a vast expanse of water in the South China Sea within the so-called 9 or 10 dash lines. This lines has no coordinates, so it is very elastic and therefore destabilizing. To me, claim to historic waters has no grounds under the 1982 UN Convention on Law of the Sea, which govern precise delineations of territorial sea, exclusive economic zone, and the continental shelf. China has precluded talk on any possibility of the dispute on the interpretation of their historic claims to any process of international adjudications. In comparisons, in ASEAN, we have no shortage of potential disputes over islands and sea boundaries. But the habits of dialogue has allowed us to settle our potential conflicts through negotiations. When negotiation was exhausted and there was no solution, while none of 10 ASEAN countries accepted the compulsory jurisdictions of the International Court of Justice, some ASEAN members referred their cases to the international adjudication, both through International Court of Justice and International Tribunal of the Law of the Sea, or some sort of arbitration. In the South China Sea, problems whether to agree to the rule of conduct of parties, namely DOC or COC, which are still in the making, but also to the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation, which we all, some 27 countries in the region, are parties to it, have made no progress. Likewise, no bilateral negotiation, which is mandated by UNCLOS to solve problems through negotiations, has not taken place, and a party even tends to flex its muscle. In conclusion, clearly, in Asia, there is a disconnection between increasing wealth and security. With the exception of ASEAN, there is an imbalance of community building process in East Asia. There is still imbalance, which is, I should repeat, imbalance of community building process in which it is happily economics and neglecting political and security agenda. There is a need to strengthen the capacity of the ASEAN Regional Forum, which is the only forum for political and security dialogue, and also the need to strengthen the East Asia Summit process. ASEAN Regional Forum has to move beyond PD, preventive diplomacy, and CBMs, confidence-building measures, including by elaborating the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation basic norms on rule of good conduct, and to proceed to process the procedure and mechanisms on peaceful conflict resolutions. For the EAS, for the East Asia Summit, they have to balance their focus on economic agenda by including more of political, security, and strategic issues. All state parties to the South China Sea conflicts should go back to the path of dialogue. Actually, it was Indonesia which initiated, since 1994, what we call the annual workshop on managing the potential conflicts in South China Sea. And I think it's time to strengthen this process from track two level to track one and a half. And I thank you for your kind attentions. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Pak Hasan, for that very frank assessment of Asia today. And of course, you're working on many of the issues you've talked about within the Bali Democracy Forum that you set up some years ago, pointing to the imbalance, basic imbalance in Asia between the economic networks and the political and security vacuums, if you like. ARF and EAS need more teeth, absolutely right, and the lack of an effective multilateral security architecture. Thank you very much indeed for that. Pak Hasan has agreed to take questions after our panel discussion, so he'll stay here and you can hold fire on any issues that you want to raise with him. I'd like to now start our panel discussion with the panelists who have already introduced. The rules of the game at Friends of Europe are very simple. I'm going to still stand here for most of the conversation. I'm going to start off with a question to each of you, perhaps with follow-ups, and then we will have enough, thank you, we will have enough time for questions and comments from the floor to our very distinguished panelists. Kimi, I'm going to start with you. We've talked about the recent meetings that have been held the recent meetings that have been held in Seoul, the trilateral meetings that have been held, the bilateral meetings that have been held. My question to you is, do you think that these gestures of conciliation, these gestures of reaching out to each other, do you think they will lead to any lasting change in the stances of the three countries involved? And if not, what are the key points in Asia, the key flashpoints in Asia that Fahasan has referred to that keep you awake at night?
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here. For your question about the trilateral meeting, and I think it was a very good start after having a cold relations, Japan and China, Japan, Korea. But then I'm quite skeptical about the situation. It will probably improve to a certain extent, but then relation. I don't think it's going to lead to a lasting peace or a complete solution of their situation. I'm afraid the Asian, Northeast Asia, Japan, China, Korea are in a sort of a vicious circle. All those historical problems and then territorial problems. As far as they're not completely resolved, they will haunt the three countries' relations and come back and hit them again. I just want to comment briefly on the naming of the panel, this cold peace, Asian security today living with a cold peace. I really like this term, cold peace. I'm a historian, so I tend to look at the situation and long-term perspectives. I understand this is a combination of Cold War and Long Peace. Long Peace is the word used by John Gaddis, a Cold War historian. The Cold War period, superpowers confronted each other, and then but they didn't go to a major war. And that was the case in U.S., Soviet, and also European context, but it wasn't the case in Asia. Cold Peace started after Vietnam War ended. And so there are collisions and tensions, but no major wars. In case of Europe, it ended in 1989-1991, whichever you look at. But then in case of Asia, Cold War still continuing. The basic structure of the Cold War confrontation still continue. China, Korea still divided. The communist regime didn't collapse. And, all those regional conflicts are still lasting from the Cold War era. U.S. Cold War alliance system still continue. So we are still in the Cold War, structure. So in that structure, this cycle of tension and relaxation tension is going around. So now bad time was for the last 10 years or so, and now with this trilateral summit, it may be improving, but I have a feeling it will come back and hit the relations again. So we should be looking at the fundamental solution eventually.
And Kimmy, the fundamental solutions, we'll talk about it in the second round, but what are the key sort of areas that you are worried about at the moment, which you think that are a potential for real concern for yourself and perhaps for us as well?
Yes, I'm sorry, I should have answered that question. So the most worrisome situation is North Korea. Other countries in the region, even with those territorial or other historical conflicts, they are talking. They have been talking in bilaterally or multilaterally using the various places, summit, bilateral summit, multilateral summit, ministerial meetings. But then in case of North Korea, the country is so isolated. It looks like it's getting pretty brutal. Unpredictable. The country has nuclear weapons and still developing missiles. All sorts of factors which we do not know well. So I do worry about the situation in North Korea. We really have to make sure that the country should not. The rest of the world shouldn't drive the country into the corner where it is the North Korea feels there's nothing to lose. I really don't want to see the country to go explosive, not just in the Korean Peninsula, because it might affect the rest of the region and also the world that it doesn't like.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Let me turn now to Ambassador Ong. Pahasan already talked a lot about ASEAN and ASEAN's centrality and the fact that the three major powers often turn to ASEAN as the neutral peace broker or cold peace broker when in times of trouble. How is ASEAN coping with this big burden of responsibility in the region? The recent news reports we've got from the region aren't so flattering for ASEAN's ability to unite around certain key issues in the region like the South China Seas.
Well, thank you, Sarah. First of all, we must acknowledge that ASEAN is not a perfect organization. We are still managing our various challenges. Overall, I would say, however, that with ASEAN, we have created a relatively peaceful and stable Southeast Asia. So going forward, Pak Hasan from Indonesia have already described in his opening remarks several of the ASEAN mechanism. These are what we call ASEAN-led mechanism. We founded the ASEAN Regional Forum. We initiated the East Asia Summit, and now we have a thing called the ASEAN Defense Minister Plus, which basically bring in 8 of the big countries from outside the region to sit down on an annual basis to talk about defense and security issues. Overall, I sometimes think without all these ideas from ASEAN, without the presence of ASEAN, Southeast Asia would have been in a worse situation. Definitely, there will be a lot of tension, noises, like what you have seen during the Cold War or during the period when Vietnam War was raging in Indochina. So going forward, I think we would have to look at ASEAN centrality in a manner which delivers some results. I don't think we can resolve all the problems we have in the region, but we should manage it competently and maintain the peaceful situation. Generally speaking, Southeast Asia is very peaceful. We have some insurgency problem in certain parts of the region, but they are not of a nature that would disrupt economic development and socio-cultural cooperation. Political cooperation has also been good in the sense that no leader in ASEAN country would want to be the one responsible for rupturing the entire situation. So, Pak Hasan has also talked about the need to do more in ASEAN Regional Forum. One of the challenges that we have in the ASEAN Regional Forum, ARF, is that it has become so big. And annually, when the foreign minister meet, I think they need a room of this size. Papa Hasan, 27... participants, each with one foreign minister and one senior official accompanying. So the old day of cozy 10 guys sitting around a table with the secretary general nearby to help them are no longer there. If you imagine each person have 3 minutes to speak, 27 country, you can take a whole morning with a tea break. So it has to be reshaped in a certain way. We have tried to stop the further expansion in terms of membership, participants in ASEAN Regional Forum. But whatever is there now, we have to work with it. And we want to go beyond just confident building. We should think about more preventive diplomacy and even maybe conflict resolution. With regard to the East Asia Summit, I agree with Pak Hasan that we need to do more. At the moment, it is a strategic dialogue of leaders talking about those things that we can do together. Unfortunately, those things are mostly economic and social, cultural cooperation. But definitely, we should do more because as developed by the ASEAN leaders, East Asia Summit is supposed to be a mechanism to manage power relations in the region. Yeah. So we have not yet used that forum for that kind of power relationship. That brings me to the underlying point about Shada's question. ASEAN centrality revolves around two concepts. One is that ASEAN as a grouping engages the big powers, the major powers interested in our region to organize the to and fro in a systematic manner without rupturing the peaceful status quo. But the other dimension of ASEAN centrality is with regard to internal national processes. Yeah. If you visited some of the ASEAN countries in recent years, you would not believe that in spite of all the talk about ASEAN community building and what have you, there has not been sufficient effort to put ASEAN into the national legislation or into the national processes. So we are somewhat delayed in our target in doing economic integration, political cooperation and all that, because the centrality of ASEAN has not yet been fully accepted into the respective national dialogue, the national legislature and the national doing and flowing in all our ASEAN member states. We still have national assemblymen or parliamentarians questioning why they have to do certain things when it is just ASEAN and it has nothing to do with the national policy of Vietnam or the national policy of Indonesia and so on and so forth. So I think the big requirement going forward is to now translate that ASEAN centrality at the national level, make our processes in all the ASEAN member states recognize that ASEAN agenda must be taken into account as each of the states in ASEAN form their rules and regulation or to do their domestic reform, and this kind of initiative or measure must contribute to the realization of the goals of the ASEAN agenda. Thank you.
Because it's true, Ambassador Ong, isn't it, that when ASEAN is united around a topic, it can get results. I'm thinking today especially of Myanmar and the result of the election. Let's see what happens next. And I was also wondering, but you don't have to answer me now, but perhaps later, is, you know, you've devoted, as all of you have said, so much time to the economic side of ASEAN. The ASEAN Economic Community, inshallah, will see the light of day in a couple of weeks. Will the next step be focusing just as much on the security and political elements of this regional grouping? So I'll ask you that in the second round. Moving now to Aidan Foster-Carter. Kimi has pointed very clearly to North Korea as the issue in Asia that worries her a great deal. And at the trilateral summit in Seoul, there was a discussion to restart the six-party talks. And I was just wondering if what your ideas are about where to take this discussion with North Korea forward.
Thank you very much, Shada, and also thank you to Friends of Europe for arranging this fine occasion. May I just say, I am a British friend of Europe. We do exist. In case you thought the contrary, but to North Korea. Does Britain want to become North Korea? No, I mustn't pursue that theme, must I? The joys of isolation are not ones that appeal to me since I spend my life looking at North Korea. I actually think, and you can send me home in disgrace, I think North Korea is insoluble. There is a line from the English comic poet Hilaire Belloc. They answered as they took their fees, there is no cure for this disease. I am not getting a fee for saying this, but I think it doesn't help that a sort of North Korea fatigue has settled upon everybody. None of North Korea's various interlocutors, none of the other five in the now imaginary six-party, not imaginary, but it's funny, there are things like the six-party talks and the Palestinian peace process, and we talk about them as if they exist, and they don't exist. The six-party talks have not met since 2008. There was a pro forma, there was indeed a gesture, the verbal gesture you always get in the latest trilateral meeting in Seoul, to try and get meaningful six-party talks. I'm sure that Japan and South Korea insisted on that word going in. China would have them under any conditions. The problem is that under Kim Jong-un, the third generation leader, North Korea's nuclear status is now written into its constitution. That's going to be quite hard to change. While there was the, cynics would say, the pretense, optimists would say the possibility that they might at some point, under some conditions at the end of a very long road of salami slicing and being paid to stop doing this and that, while there was at least a theoretical possibility that the North Koreans might give up their nuclear weapons, you could have talks. If they've got it written into the Constitution, I rather wonder what you can do. Could I say one other thing about North Korea? I was for many years a collapsist. I think I may have coined that actual word as the opposite of gradualist. Many of us influenced by the wonderful events of 1989 and 90 when tyranny crumbled and Europe became one again, assumed that the contradictions of North Korea, its oppression of its own people, its poking all of the rest of us in the eye with state crime nuclear, said that surely this can't last. This view continues. President Obama said something similar, and I saw that just today, Kim Moo-sung, a name you should remember because he might be the next president of South Korea, he's the leader of the ruling party, has done his little bit for inter-Korean relations by saying he thinks the North will collapse in 3 years. The point is, even if you think that, probably if you're in that position, you shouldn't say it. But it's on it, and I am in print from the 1990s saying it will definitely collapse when Kim Il-sung dies, or failing that by 2000. Well, it's still there. And of course, you can't go to the opposite extreme and say there is no circumstance under which it would collapse. We've got another purge, it seems. Choe Ryong-hae, who only a month or so ago was North Korea's rather lowly representative on the dais in Beijing, when President Park Geun-hye of South Korea, of course, was a prominent guest at China's military march past. Well, Choe Ryong-hae, maybe he didn't. Although we think that relations between China and North Korea are now slightly on the mend, two senior Chinese have visited Pyongyang. Choe Ryong-hae suddenly seems to be vanished from a funeral committee. This is the sort of arcana. How do you know what's happening? You read the funeral committees. That's how we do the job on North Korea. But it endures, and the economy, if Pyongyang is anything to go by, and it is much more prosperous than the rest of the country, there seems to be a certain amount of wealth. The young leader, although he may be brutal with his purges, he wants special economic zones. It's not clear who will come apart from China, but maybe it suffices that China will come, because the economic relationship with China has always continued. But I could go on a long time about North Korea, and I think it's somebody else's turn, probably.
Yeah, I do want to follow up with, so if it's not going to collapse, what is the best approach? I mean, isolation isn't working, obviously. Engagement of some sort?
The trouble, again, I hate to be, I am personally an optimist, but I sound ultimately, I sound negative on this. Neither works. You have to try engagement. Isolation can't be done because, for this reason, and here is a real problem for international law. Quite rightly, when the North Koreans have tested a nuclear device 3 times, and when they have also launched long-range ballistic missiles, which may or may not double as space vehicles, the United Nations Security Council unanimously, Russia and China on board, has condemned these, and sanctions are put in place. But the sanctions, although each time they get a little bit tighter, they are far from watertight, and there is no suggestion at this point of banning all trade. Some countries unilaterally, Japan, for example, has banned trade completely. But for as long as you have China, with its long and porous border with North Korea, taking the decision that even though they are almost but never quite terminally irritated with North Korea, nonetheless, they don't want it to collapse. By the way, if anyone wonders, you get the question, why would China want to support North Korea? Well, population movements and refugees is one issue. I don't think any European, after what we're seeing at the moment and this year, should fail. I'm not saying you have to agree with China, but I don't think there's any excuse for not understanding the situation that China actually wants to avoid. So as long as China's propping it up, and in South Korea, if the left ever gets back into power, they would probably reverse current policy and have a more active pursuit of engagement. While that's going on, then isolation isn't really going to work at all. But quite honestly, although I'm pro-engagement, it's hard to see what it has accomplished either. And of course, the fact of democracy, a wonderful thing, not yet in China, but in South Korea and America, elections are held, presidents change, and the line on North Korea changes completely overnight.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bonji Ohara, I want to turn to you. Not about North Korea, though I know Japan is very, very concerned about North Korea. But I really want to come to the Japan-China relationship. Now, the headlines recently have been quite good. I mean, Premier Li Keqiang has met Prime Minister Abe. But really, it's also a lot about tension, acrimony about past animosities. Is anything really happening to try and bring these two countries to work better together for the future of their common space, their continent?
Thank you, Shada. And I think the summit meeting itself is not the place to solve the problems. It's not the place to discuss the each concrete problems. But it still has meaning, and it's important because two countries show the intention to improve relationship. So it has huge meaning for the both countries. Actually, the ministries and organizations and private companies kept discussing about the cooperation between the two countries. Include the Ministry of Defense. Japan and China decided to build the crisis management mechanism in last November. But we've not concluded yet because of the bad political relationship. Even though the ministries keeping discussing the these issues. So the summit meeting has influence on this discussion, especially in China. The ministries and organization understood the intention of President Xi to improve the relationship between Japan. Then I expect that the both countries can conclude some issues. Not only securities, but also the about climate change, air pollution, water pollution, and other economic arena. So it has good influence, I think. But still, the we have problems. Of course, we have the problems concerning the territorial dispute over the Senkaku Islands. Chinese said the Ryukyu. But it is the only part of the political problem. It is not main issue, I think. But now the Chinese side always, when they say, I insist that Japanese new security policy is also concerned historical problem. But it's quite different things. So I'm always explaining the Japanese new security policy, a meaning of the security policy, even in China, with Chinese friends. So the meaning of the Japanese new security policy is just try to show the intention to cooperate with countries to deal with threat from inside and outside from international society. So, but on the other hand, I cannot deny the one of the reasons is the behavior of China recently in the East China Sea and the South China Sea. But still, we have room to discuss about it. China is inviting me to attend the conference in China, even though I'm always claiming the Chinese behavior in Japan, in TV or magazines.
Thank you, Bonji. One thing that I find interesting is that next year, Japan is head of the G7, and China will be head of the G20. I find that quite an interesting and I would say good coincidence. Will that lead to any kind of closer relationship on a more daily basis that could perhaps result in a sort of easing of these very, very long-held animosities?
Yes, I think the we have to leave from the image of confrontation and also from the image of rivalry, because Japan cannot be the rival of China. We are asymmetric. China is huge countries, and Japan is very small countries. China has the 10 times population of Japan, and Japan does not have enough resources inside Japan. And the economic structure is also different. And, I understand China is trying to change, reform the economic structure inside of China. So the Chinese GDP is, of course, bigger than Japan. It's usual thing. We don't have to scale up the, this reality. But we still have some issues to cooperate if the China need to Japanese help when it try to reform the economic structure inside of China, because Japan has experience. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, let's not forget that Japan led the growth of the so-called East Asian tigers and obviously has played a good big role in the development of China. So I wouldn't be that modest about big and small. I think quality of growth also is very, very important. But thank you very much indeed, Bongi. We'll come back to some of the issues you've raised. It's an interesting article the other day in which I, Aidan pointed it out to me, was that the Asia-Pacific kitchen is big enough to accommodate two chefs. So I think perhaps we have to talk about whether that is the case or not in Asia. Moving now to Sebastian. Sebastian, the rise in arms spending, I mean, we haven't referred to it, and of course the Europeans are big sellers of weapons to the rest of Asia. It's a big booming market. But the rise in arms spending, how long can this go on within a cold peace paradigm?
Well, thank you, Shada, for having the opportunity to be here again in Brussels, and it feels good. I spent 3.5 years recently in China, and that felt very good as well, because it actually provides more perspectives. And certainly this issue of economic development on the one side and security and political development on the other side is a very specific character. The way how you can observe it in Asia is very specific. Actually, there is economic convergence, but there is political and security divergence. That differs from what we in Europe have experienced, and that is obviously linked to the question of security. And why is that? Because security dilemmas loom large in East Asia, whereas they don't within the European Union. So I think that from a comparative perspective, it helps to provide context and also to understand why the situation in East Asia is indeed special. Now, is the peace sustainable? I'm not so sure, because there are no, as my predecessors have already mentioned, there are no strong institutions that help to sustain this peace. What does that mean? That means that the increasing economic and interdependence, and also the increasing exchange of amongst the peoples of East Asia, the civil society. Think, for instance, of tourism and all this, these exchanges. What is missing is a kind of institutional fabric that helps to allow to deal peace in a peaceful way with conflicts. And at the same time, conflicts are important for the development of any given society, but also of a region. Now, speaking of East Asia, obviously, we can make the point that there are two huge sub-regions, that is Northeast Asia and Southeast Asia, And the way how regional processes of cooperation and integration have functioned so far, have worked out so far in both regions, differ. ASEAN certainly has, over the course of the last, nearly five decades, provided an extremely important function in providing peace and prosperity within those now 10 countries, and also becoming a kind of, not an external federator, but becoming the facilitator of regional cooperation processes in the broader, in the wider region. East Asia Summit has been mentioned. ASEAN Plus 3 actually hasn't yet, which was the first important step in this process, meaning that Southeast Asia and Northeast Asia, those two, you could even argue, security complexes, they are, the question is, do they merge? And they do in the sense that institutions have been developed, like the ASEAN Regional Forum, for instance, EAS has been mentioned as well, but those institutions are weak. They have yet not provided any solution to the Korean Peninsula, even though the DPRK is a member of ARF, for instance. Nor have they provided any solution to the, for instance, to maritime territorial disputes like the South China Sea that has been mentioned as well. So there is this asymmetry, there is this paradox of condivergence, so to speak, right? These parallel developments. And this all leads to a situation in which security dilemmas continue to loom large, if not to say become even more substantive. And that is unnerving, if not to say that is a situation that asks for more political input from all sides and all actors, state actors and non-state actors. I think another way of looking at it is that we also need to take into consideration whether these processes work top-down or bottom-up. So, indeed, civil society is important, as it is obviously in Europe.
There are two interesting things that you watch and see when you look at Asia today. There's also serious economic competition. You have the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You have the RCEP. You have China's One Belt, One Road initiative. I think these are parallel competing initiatives. And of course, South Korea, Japan, and China also have a trilateral cooperation secretariat in Seoul. So there seems to be a kind of movement on many, many fronts, but as you said, Sebastian, perhaps less convergence into a more stable and secure security architecture. Would you agree with that?
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. And obviously those two dimensions, they impact on each other. In the case of Northeast Asia, the idea is that further institutionalization of economic interdependence by with the help of free trade agreements, for instance, that will also provide the kind of will lead to political institutions that can help to deal with conflicts, at least in the area of trade. But the broader structure here obviously is a kind of geo-economic aspect, meaning that there is China, and there is the United States, and there is Asia Pacific, and the question is how will those, I think the new jargon is spheres of influence, how will it play out? And right now, so far, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is US-centered, whereas you mentioned One Belt, One Road, so the new Silk Road, but there is also the RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which is very much favored by China, although ASEAN-centered in the sense that the already existing bilateral FTAs between ASEAN and those other six countries will be brought together. That at least is the idea. So you have this, you have those two centers, so to speak. You have those two processes. One very much China oriented, the other one US oriented. And there is one more thing here, I think, that we should also think about: the way how these regional processes of cooperation and integration work, they differ quite a lot. So far, when we talk about ASEAN, everybody has probably heard the term ASEAN way, which is very central to the whole, to ASEAN, to ASEAN's identity. It's consensus-based. It's non-interference into each other's affairs. And in a way, it's non-binding. Now, all these regional trade initiatives, Asia-Pacific Economic Forum even, they are all non-binding. TPP is binding. RCEP, we are not quite sure, but RCEP is also, it tends to be more open. Open regionalism comes in here. So there are those, there is this question, will ask, how sustainable is the ASEAN way? Don't we need a legalistic turn here? Isn't it time to come up with a more rules-based approach to regional cooperation and integration in East Asia?
That is indeed, I think, a $64 million question, and rightly put as well. Last but not least, Andrew, we've seen some very historic moves over the last weekend. We've seen a meeting after 66 years between a Chinese president and the leader of Taiwan. I was wondering, give us a little bit, Andrew, your assessment of this, of the importance of this meeting, and whether it heralds something, a new era perhaps in relations across the straits?
Well, Shada, first of all, thank you for your invitation to participate in this very important seminar. I'm intrigued by the panel topics today. You mentioned the co-peace paradigm. I just want to make a little bit remarks about this based on our experiences in Taiwan over the last 60 years or so. My comments is that if you continue to live in a co-environment, it doesn't actually conducive to the peaceful existence, because I can share you with our experiences for the last 60 years in terms of cross-strait relations. As you're probably aware, I mean the audience probably also aware, that Taiwan and mainland China has experienced regular confrontational relations in the past. Occasionally, we have a very severe confrontation taking place in Taiwan Strait area, certainly, which create a lot of tension escalation and also create tremendous anxieties and uncertainties among our populations as well. Certainly, it is not a peaceful coexistence with each other. So we consider maintaining co-relations or co-environment, which is counterproductive and negative to our future progress. That is the reason why I think that this administration, President Mao's administration, are starting to rehash the so-called 1992 consensus, which has been created between Taiwan and the mainland China during 1992 to set aside political disputes and focusing on managing the practical issues which were benefiting both sides in terms of people's welfare. I think that that decision certainly has created tremendous opportunities for both sides to solve the ice. Instead of creating more icy environment, we are making efforts to solve the ice across the Taiwan Strait, and resulted in signing 23 agreements, which will benefiting people's livelihood, trade, investment, and certainly create the opportunity for official contact at the different levels as well, which certainly leading to the recent Mr. Xi and Mr. Ma meeting in Singapore only days ago. I think those are the efforts we made for the last 7.5 years, which I consider as a very important element adding into the concerns, as all the panelists has mentioned earlier, that there are sporadic tensions, anxieties, institutions or mechanisms not actually work very effectively. However, the examples that both sides of the Taiwan Strait are committed into peaceful engagement over the 7.5 years and create a peaceful and stable environment in the Taiwan Strait regions really provide the examples for other neighboring actors to think about how to make efforts to managing their attention environment as well. And I think the peaceful engagement between two sides also leading to the efforts for Taiwan to create the opportunity to reach out to settle all the difficulties in terms of their neighboring environments, such as the East China Sea Peace Initiative, also resulted in signing the peace fishery agreement between Japan and Taiwan so as to provide a safety and stable environment for both countries to conduct fishery activities in the East China Sea area, which is certainly acknowledged and recognized by countries as well. Another good example is the South China Sea Initiative, which also leading to possible law enforcement agreement signed between the Philippines and Taiwan in the near future, which certainly will be adding another element in terms of preserving peace and stability in the region. So I think that Taiwan is not actually very much exposure to the regional forum or multilateral mechanisms, unfortunately. However, we are making efforts to, send the message, also alert the regional actors that focusing on the efforts to solve the ice and also making contributions to enhance mutual trust, you can identify ways to accommodate each other's interests so as to lead into a better future security environment in the future.
Andrew, there used to be a time when cross-strait relations were almost in the same category as North Korea, when we in Europe looked at Asia and thought about the different hotspots, etc. Now, thankfully, that is not up there in the top, let's say, security flashpoints. You also have ECFA between China and Taiwan. But you have elections coming up in January, and it's unpredictable. We're not very sure what's going to happen. So I was wondering whether this easing of tensions that we see at the moment, this better relationship, this rapprochement, is something that can be sustainable, durable.
Well, I do not hold the crystal ball to predict the result of the general election next January. However, I think the efforts made for the last 7.5 years has been acknowledged and recognized by international community. I think the EU community, as well as the major country around the world, repeatedly acknowledging that the efforts made by Taiwan, I mean in China, in terms of contributing to a peaceful environment in the region, is welcome. I think that that has been a message on the wall. I think people in Taiwan should acknowledge this merits, and certainly they have to evaluate their continuous and future generational welfare in terms of how to maintain peace and stable environment in the Taiwan Strait area, and at the same time, and making efforts for Taiwan to be more participating in international space. This certainly will be good options for people taking into their reference in the process of casting their votes in the near future.
Indeed. Thank you very much to all the panelists for putting yourselves through very, very nicely through my interrogation. I have to say, you've been very, very good in answering all the questions I've put to you. I'd like to now open the floor to questions, short questions and comments from all of you. I see there are many, many old friends and colleagues here who know a lot of, a great deal about Asia, Asian security as well. If I could have a show of hands at this point about the people who would like to ask questions. I'm sure Glenn, David, Jan Willem, I'm sure Nagayo are already there. Do I see any other hands? The light, yes. Yes, of course. My friend Aris. Okay, so we have about 35 minutes or so for questions. If I could ask you to, if it's a specific question for this panel, don't forget that there is another panel later on which will discuss European issues, how Europe and NATO can perhaps help contribute to this lack of a security architecture. But these panelists have raised some very, very good points. So let me start off with David Fouquet, European Institute for Asian Studies. Put up your hand, David.
Thanks very much. I can't help but feel that we're starting off on a premise that Asia needs the kind of mechanisms, architectures, systems that we've developed in Europe over the last 50 years, some of which have failed, been abrogated, disregarded, and I just wonder whether muddling through the ASEAN way or the Asian way is not a sustainable alternative. There are problems with either.
That's a good question.
The highly legalistic, structured systems that we like in Europe, and there are problems with renegade states, outlaw states, or whatever, in Europe or in Asia. I think that's the fate of international public governance and diplomacy, whatever system you adopt. So I'm not quite sure whether that's a question, but you put me on the spot, and I'll see what the reaction is with the panel.
Thank you. All people who come to Friends of Europe conferences have to make a contribution, intellectual one. So thank you very much for that question. Ong, would you like to take up that challenge?
Yes. Thank you, Shada. Well, I think the dilemma facing ASEAN country, at least, I can't speak for the rest of the Asian region, is that we have an organic way of doing things, but in our international relations, in our posturing of ASEAN vis-a-vis the big powers that are interested in our region, there is always references to antecedents, which is based on all these antecedents are based on certain rule of law, certain paradigm that have been tried maybe in the European Union. We go along with that. I think most ASEAN member countries feel that some of these mechanism, institutions that have been tested, processes have been tested elsewhere, are workable. In some cases, not exactly suitable for Southeast Asia. You know, your topic here is about the Asian paradox. What's wrong with paradox? Yeah.
It makes us nervous. It makes us nervous.
No, but you have to get used to the idea there is such a thing called benevolent paradox, dynamic paradox, or in my case, I like to argue for a coherent paradox. You know, we are full of paradoxes, but somehow we coalesce in response to a specific challenge or a specific situation. And then we use your experiences, especially in Europe, with regard to the regional integration and dealing with various issues, to see how existing tested model can be used. If not, then we devise our own way of doing it. The ASEAN way is nothing unusual. No, don't believe in this mystical thing called the ASEAN way. It is like what you have here in Europe. We do things in a consultative manner. We try our best not to interfere with people's household. You cannot go into someone's house and rearrange his furniture in the living room. Yeah, I think that is a belief, or that is a good practice European or Americans have too. But yes, sometimes you may not like the gaudy way in which we decorate our living room, and to be accepted by people elsewhere, we minimize the gaudiness. But overall, some of the processes are good ones, and we should use them. ASEAN way basically is to avoid a confrontation. Always people say you must interfere and deal with something. But to do so means that we will put ourselves in a very competitive position and having to confront things that we like, somebody don't like. But overall, the processes in Southeast Asia have served us well. And one of the things that we must always bear in mind is that many of these things that we implemented or invented along the way deal with a certain specific set of circumstances. Yeah, historical circumstances and political situation. But if it doesn't work, I think we try to adjust it. Yeah, Chinese leader Xi Jinping like to say, mutual benefit and mutual accommodation. Yeah. And then they recently added in this thing called mutual adaptation. So perhaps we are just like that.
But I think we can talk about it later on, but I think the paradigm is changing, the environment is changing, and ASEAN, frankly, is changing as well. Bonji, you wanted to come in as well. Pa Hasan, would you like to answer that as well, or later?
Yes, thank you, Shada. And yes, I agree with you that the situation in Asia is different from the Europe. Now, we cannot share the slight perception between Asian countries. So ASEAN and ARF are very important for discussion, but do not work well when it comes to deal with SLED, take the concrete action. So I think the we need some flexible framework, not only institution, and also the networked bilateral cooperation. We don't have to get the agreement from the all of participants, but also need based on business. So the every country are interested in these kind of framework. And I think the European countries have the experience, and I hope the European countries to help Asian country to build this kind of framework. And I have the project in Japan of these ideas. And actually, the European country has already been interested in the ideas. I cannot say which countries, but we've already started discussing about it. Thank you.
Thank you. Kimi, would you like to come in?
Okay. To follow up, you know, I think the situation in Asia is more like a little bit similar to the Europe in the 70s. What Asian Regional Forum is in Asia, it's more like a CSCE rather than OSCE. It's in the, you know, more, it's not a solid institution yet, but then, you know, still a good place to, you know, for dialogue. So while in the case of Europe, it took another 20, 30 years, not 20 years. So ages behind, but then hopefully with borrowing ideas and learning from the lessons of Europe, hope they will get to where Europe is now and several decades later.
Thank you very much. Unless anyone else, I'd like to take another question. I just put up your hand, Iris, please. Yeah. Yes. Keep your hand up because my colleagues can see. Yeah, please.
Iris Kokinos from Euroborder.com. A question for Mr. Bersik. Speaking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and about ASEAN, you've mentioned the binding nature of the first association and the non-binding nature of the second one. What do you think would be a good middle term for a good cooperation between these two associations, given the fact that some countries are members of both TPP and ASEAN? Mm.
Sebastian, would you like to answer that?
Well, thank you for the question. First of all, obviously, we need to know what actually TPP is about. The negotiations have been finalized. However, still questions remain. TPP will apply high standards, generally speaking, on liberalization. So this is not the case in ASEAN. How those countries, that is, how Vietnam and Brunei and Malaysia, how they will actually deal with this challenge, I think that is one of the very interesting things to be observed in the future. We don't know, but one thing is for sure: it's a different. It's a different system that they are entering. And the question is whether a kind of diffusion will take place between those different systems. And this is what you are referring to. My expectation is that indeed ASEAN will take some mileage out of this in order to push forward their own regional aspiration in terms of integration. And this is what they do, because at the end of this year, the community, the ASEAN economic community, will become, well, will set in, right? So the big question is actually, what does that mean? ASEAN is under pressure, has been under pressure, to react to China's and India's economic development and so-called rise. They have, instead of implementing the ASEAN community, instead of implementing it, aiming for implementing it in 2020, they have pushed it forward to 2015. That in itself is an indicator for this urge to move forward here. That how it will work out in concrete terms right now, we don't know. Maybe, certainly there's a lot to say.
We can continue with that. Ong, do you want to come in very quickly?
Yeah.
Very quickly.
I think the way I describe the difference between TPP and RCEP to my wife, she asked the same question, is that RCEP is more cooperative. You do something for me, in return, I do something for you. In the case of TPP, it's collaborative. Remember, if you are the conductor in the orchestra, the conductor will give you the notes for playing a particular piece of classical music. The guy with the violin has to work with the guy with the trombone and so on and so forth. So it's collaborative. Yeah. And there is a fundamental difference, because in the case of the collaborative, we are all in the same orchestra. You don't do the right thing, the music will not be right. In the case of RCEP, we already have ASEAN-China agreement, ASEAN-Japan, ASEAN-India, and so on and so forth. So now we are trying to integrate them, and it is a deal. You do something for me, I do something for you. That's basically the first level of difference. Second level is more structural. In the case of TPP, some of the ASEAN countries in the TPP and those from South America, they have to really reorganize their domestic way of dealing with issues such as government procurement and state-owned enterprises. Yeah. Whereas the RCEP, we are not so ambitious. We are just happy to be able to collaborate and be a member of this club. And to be a member of this club, you have to do three or four things: reduce tariff, reduce non-tariff barrier, and things like that. The objective is to increase trade and flow of investment. In the case of TPP, there is even more ambition. It's not just improving trade and increasing investment. I am trying to restructure some of the way in which business and government and private sector are collaborating. Thank you.
Interesting breakfast conversations, Ong. I envy you. If I could ask, Jan Willem, do you have a question? Anyone at the back? I can. Yes, Brian, I've seen you.
Not really a question, a few remarks. My name is Willem Blanket, and I work on, I was a cross-strait watcher for the European Union and later worked on EU-ASEAN relations. I feel that we could be a bit more optimistic, perhaps. 10 years ago, we had the anti-secession law. Nowadays, what was it, a few weeks ago, we had a one-minute Singapore handshake of Mr. Xi and Ma. I mean, that's something to celebrate, I would say. We have this comparison between ASEAN weak, EU strong. There are those who feel that there is too much institution in the European Union, and that's why the UK is considering to leave. I'm of course partisan. I was 5 years working with ASEAN in Jakarta. I think ASEAN's role as a stabilizer in the region is very much underestimated. And again, institutions, the EU and Russia, have a very tense situation today in spite of certain institutions that exist for cooperation. ASEAN, when you compare, has a much more relaxed relationship with its big neighbor, China. So I think I just put it in as food for thought, but we could perhaps be a tiny little bit more optimistic. It struck me that Mrs. Mogherini, a few days ago, after the ASA meeting with 58 countries, got 3 questions all on the South China Sea. That's it.
53 countries in ASEAN, but thank you very much for putting an optimistic note into our discussion. Brian, please, could you put up your hand? Please, I'm very happy to take questions from people at the back, and I can see you, so please do put up your hands.
Thank you. On that last point Secretary General mentioned, if I understand it correctly, the TPP is quite difficult for China to become a member of, precisely because of these domestic issues like state-owned corporations. I mean, is that true? That's my first point. The second one is directed to Professor Yang. Was there actually some content in the meeting in Singapore between President Ma and President Xi Jinping, other than the handshake and the friendly relations aspect of it? And thirdly, there are these new banks. I wonder if somebody could comment on that. I mean, the BRICS Bank seems... I don't really want comments on the Asia Infrastructure Bank. I understand that. But I understand the BRICS Bank is like a mini IMF. And is that a welcome development? And how is that going to work? Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Does anyone else have a question at this point before I turn to the panelists? Okay. If not, Ambassador Ong, would you like to take the question about China and the TPP?
To a certain extent, I agree with you. The way the TPP program has been designed, you require to make drastic changes to your system unless you have really been in that operative mode. But there's a misunderstanding about how to get into TPP. The idea is that the existing 12 countries cannot say, I selectively invite you to join. If you are interested to work with them on the TPP, you can actually ask to join the TPP processes, which is what Indonesia had done recently when His Excellency, the President of Indonesia, visited Washington, D.C., he has expressed an interest in looking at how Indonesia can be involved in the TPP. So I think the 12 participants in the TPP negotiation currently, they take that stand because it is not designed to exclude anybody. But if you are ready, you want to come in, you indicate your readiness, and then you start to work on the various issues. So China, for a while, we in Singapore feel that China was focused on the RCEP because it's something more deliverable. We already have those existing free trade agreements. You just have to combine them into a certain workable fashion, which is not difficult to do if we have some political will in all the countries.
Thank you. And wait till the EU starts negotiating its free trade, long-awaited free trade agreement with ASEAN. Sebastian, please, yes.
Well, actually, the question whether China should join TPP is fiercely debated within China, right? And there are two sides here, one, well, pro, one contra. The argument goes that if China joined TPP, that would help to stimulate, to facilitate the reform process. And that is linked to, of course, to the question how the whole domestic economy has been structured. You mentioned enterprises, state-owned enterprises. There is also the position that China would actually lose room of maneuver, would lose influence on processes of standardization, because suddenly it would have to adopt to the regulations within TPP. But at the same time, and this is another position, as long as you're out, you have no opportunity to have influence on the ongoing negotiations with regard to standards, which is why there are people, some people argue that actually the question of TPP is more important than the question of the South China Sea in terms of having impact on China's overall development, because the TPP is linked to the domestic development of the economy, thereby to the internal stability of the system, of the overall political system, whereas, and that's not the case with the South China Sea.
Thank you very much. Andrew, there was a question directed at you. Thank you.
Well, the question is directed to Mr. Ma and Mr. Xi's meeting in Singapore. As a matter of fact, I was accompanying Mr. Ma to travel to the Singapore's 3 days ago. So I personally observed the process. I share with you the press release in terms of President Ma's made the 5 points in the opening sessions with the attendance of the media people. Actually, the 5 points he emphasized in terms of reinforcing the peaceful and prosperous status quo across Taiwan Strait are, number one, consolidation of the 1992 consensus and the maintenance of the peace. Second, reduction of hostility and peaceful handling of the disputes across the straits. Number three, expansion of cross-strait exchanges and mutual benefits. The fourth element is establishment of a cross-strait hotline to handle important or urgent matters. And finally, joint cooperation for cross-strait prosperity. And during the closed-door meeting, Mr. Mao also brought up other issues, including trading in goods, the reciprocal establishment of representatives' offices on both sides, transit in Taiwan for mainland Chinese travelers, and also demanding more international space in participation in regional economic integration such as RCEP, TPP, and bilateral economic cooperation. He also mentioned the concern over the military threats on the other side of the Taiwan Strait. And he also expressed the hope that the mainland Chinese side will handle these matters in a pragmatic fashion and urge both sides to work under conditions of mutual respect towards substantive progress on issues already under negotiation. And certainly, I think those remarks made by Mr. Ma is well taken by Mr. Xi and taken into consideration and probably will be continue to discuss those issues in the near future.
So quite a substantive discussion, the one-minute handshake and a meal, but also real important conversation.
I think that both sides express very sincerely in terms of conducting their exchanges.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anyone want to take up the question of the competing and the different banks that are being set up in the region? Aidan, would you feel comfortable doing this or anyone else? Yeah? Yeah. Please do.
Sorry, I'm not a bank expert, so I fear I won't answer the direct question, but I wanted to say a bit more about the article that Shada already alluded to, because your homework is to go home and read this wonderful article by He Ping, I hope I pronounced that right, Chinese name, surname H-E, at Fudan University, presumably you know him, published on the ever-useful EastAsiaForum.org, which is put out by ANU, and this is the one which Shada's already quoted, suggests that the region is big enough to accommodate two chefs, China and Japan. Obviously, the Korean in me must insist there should at least be a kimchi sous chef. The serious point I want to make is there's much more to the article than these quips. It's a very measured, I mean, I hope there are a lot of people in China thinking like this, I don't know if there are, about how it's not China versus Japan. He manages to talk about how China can learn from Japan. And the thing I wanted to specifically mention was that it's rather good having all these banks. Well, if we say that Japan is a major sponsor of the ADB, and just as China is a major sponsor or creator of the new AIIB, isn't this good for everybody else? Because it means that for the great infrastructural and other needs of the region, that there's a certain amount of beneficial competition going on. That was the end point I wanted to make.
My point really is, if you have a collect,
please.
If you have a separate style of IMF bank, it has big implications for policy and how you handle economic crises. I mean, that's my point. And is that actually the case? Is that what the purpose of this bank is?
I think, yes, Song.
Thank you, Shada. The starting point, as I understand it, for all these banks, BRICS or AIIB or the Silk Road Fund, is to have a Santa Claus who will give a big gift to the institution and to engage in specific area of work in, I think, all the cases it has to do with infrastructure development with a minimal of rules and processing. Financing would be much easier than, say, with the World Bank or the IMF or the ADB. This is the express intention. But in practical terms, at least we see that in the AIIB already, the relevant mechanism which they set up to process application for projects and funding would bring us into a certain degree of robust scrutiny of viability of the project and so on and so forth. So while you may have a very rich donor who can give money to start the bank going, whether it can expedite many of these infrastructure development projects depends on the respective mechanism which the BRICS Bank will have, or the AIIB will have, or the other funds will have. The express opinion is that it should be faster and more effective than the World Bank or IMF. But later on, when you are the guy who gives the money, you will probably want to ask more questions than just giving the money and say that you are different from the borrower next door. No?
Yeah, absolutely. Sebastian, you're welcome to come in, but very quickly, because I would like to start wrapping up. But please, no. Pahasan, would you like to... Clotilde, could you bring the... Would you like to say a few words after having listened to this panel discussion and the commentaries from the floor?
Yes, I wish to give my comments on two things. One on Asia and the fact that Asia has no traditions for working together through regional cooperation or organizations. In Europe, you have a good tradition since years 1800s by developing various functional organizations and eventually leading to a multi-purpose, even a supranational organization to like the European Union, but not in Asia. It was ASEAN which initiated the first regional organization in the regions in the past 48 years, and it's only natural that while ASEAN is not only focusing on their intra-ASEAN cooperation, but ASEAN has been active bridge builder. But for example, in larger East Asia, meaning 18 countries which are participating at the East Asian Summit, it's only developed in the past 10 years. So they say we cannot expect that East Asia Summit would be a better structure. After all, our approach has been, like in ASEAN, step by step, bottom up, rather the top down approach, like you did here in Europe since 1957. On TPP and RCEP, there's a much discussions about this. To me, TPP and RCEP eventually are the main constituents of what would be larger Asia-Pacific free trade area. Don't forget that in 1994 at the APEC summit in Bogor, south of Jakarta, leaders of the APEC economies agreed on developing an APEC-wide trade and liberalization of trade and investment. And last year, APEC leaders agreed to develop APEC-wide free trade area, which is, to me, eventually will take place in the region. So I don't think we need to contradict between RCEP, which is an ASEAN-sponsored process, with TPP. I must admit that TPP is a high generations of free trade area, but at the same time, we cannot say RCEP would be rather loose in the sense that not binding agreements, because through RCEP we will see in place an East Asia wide free trade and investment area, meaning agreements, meaning binding to all of us. Another reason not to contradict between TPP and RCEP is that 4 of 12 TPP participants are ASEANs, ASEAN members, while 10 ASEAN also are in RCEP. But to me, it is a matter of time, as eventually we will see an Asia-Pacific wide free trade area, some 22 member countries, as was agreed last year. And according to the Bogor goals, the liberalization of trade and investment in the larger Asia-Pacific would be should be attained by 2020, so only 5 years from now. So while TPP and RCEP are the main constituents, eventually it would lead to the wider Asia-Pacific region. That's why for a country like Indonesia, my advice to my government then is for us to process it rather step by step. While ASEAN is focusing, starting end of this year, with its own economic community process, we had in place ASEAN free trade areas since 2012, and we have quite a degree of free trade arrangement in ASEAN. But when under ASEAN economic community, we determined to make ASEAN, we'll have in place a free flow of goods, services, capital, and skilled labors, then of course we have to not so much on free flow of goods, but on free flow of services. There's a lot of work to do by ASEAN, in particular to design standards, which is huge task. That's why, to me, for a country like Indonesia, better for us to gradually address, yes, free trade area within ASEAN and ASEAN economic community and ASEAN plus one free trade areas, meaning ASEAN with its six partners, then RCEP, and eventually APEC, free trade area. And while President Joko Widodo said during his visit in Washington that Indonesia intend to be to join TPP, but I believe it may take some time for us to study well, you know, because as I said, TPP is a high generation of free trade area. There are big issues which were not able to be resolved at the WTO. And there's a big gap between the developing and developed countries, such as on intellectual property rights, on government procurements, on the role or no role of rather of the state-owned enterprises. These are now under issues which are covered by TPP. I don't think developing countries, like Pak Ong has just said, how do we cope with this, you know? But at least we need quite a process of adjustment. So I can imagine, and it is also like in China, it's hotly debated, you know, whether we should or should not join TPP. But to me, we need to have a better preparation at home, and those issues are difficult issues for us. I can imagine, as President Jokowi is now very strong, has a strong policy and on infrastructure, would our infrastructure development open to any multinational companies to join it? Well, we know our companies, including state-owned companies, are not in a position to compete with them. So these are practical issues which hamper developing countries in ASEAN, I believe also China, to, as of now, join TPP. But the two, TPP and RCEP, should not be contradicted. They are the same, would be under the same umbrella of APEC free trade area. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pak Hasan. I think that brings us very nicely to the end of this first session. I think we've had quite a wide-ranging discussion of certain key flashpoints, security points, and our panelists have been very good at looking ahead and looking forward to ways of dealing it. The conversation will continue. Also remember that just a few days ago in Luxembourg, 53 Asian and European foreign ministers met, and there was a very, very good and substantial conversation there as well on security. We've talked about the ASEAN way, and I think it has indeed, as you said, Ambassador Ong, worked so far, but it is under strain in a globalized world.
world, and I think it will have to adapt. ARF and the EAS that we've talked about will have to change and adapt to new global challenges, including 21st security challenges. The world is more complex, and the informal structures, I think, need to be bolstered by something slightly more solid. And it will, as I said to you, this is something that you owe the region, because it needs peace and stability, but I think it also owes it to the world, which depends on Asia, not just for navigation routes, but for growth, development, and worldwide security. So please join me in thanking our panelists, and there's coffee outside, and we'll be back here at 11:30 for our second session, where we will be talking about European, NATO, and Asian inter-exchanges. Thank you very much.